obvious PR win for the bank if it gets to pay its settlement money as donations to liberal darlings instead of having to call it fines. By the way, if they're charitable donations, they also become tax deductible. Even more money saved for the bank, and even less going to the federal government and the citizens that it represents. But you might overlook an important benefit to the executive branch that comes from the fines being turned into donations. If they're fines, they naturally go to the U.S. Treasury, and the Constitution says, "No money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law." That means that Congress decides what happens to that bank money. But if it turns into donations instead of fines, the money never goes to the Treasury, and the executive branch gets to decide where it goes. This is the woke industrial complex at its finest. Three separate pillars of American society working in concert to scratch each other's backs. There are even more wins and favors being exchanged between the executive branch, banks, and woke nonprofits than you might expect. It's not just a quid pro quo. I lose track of how many quids and pros there should be. But you cannot create something from nothing. The American people end up with far less money than they should, and they lose the ability to have their elected representatives decide what to do with it. And that's just the executive branch version of the scheme to use nonprofits to advance liberal causes. The judicial branch wets its beak too. The scam is fundamentally the same. When corporations reach settlements over their wrongdoing, judges and lawyers find ways to direct the money to their pet causes instead of to the people who were wronged. Since the lawyers representing clients against these corporations are disproportionately liberal, those pet causes are often progressive ones. This scam happens via an old trust law doctrine called the Cypre doctrine. It derives from a French phrase meaning as near as possible. The idea started out as a good one. When a court is determining how to apply the terms of a trust, if taking those terms literally would be impossible, the court should try to do the next best thing. For instance, in a classic 19th century example, a court repurposed a trust that had been created to abolish slavery in the United States to instead provide charity to poor African Americans. Thanks to Ted Frank for explaining all this to me, as well as telling me about some of the other examples in this chapter. That makes sense. But in recent years, the trust law doctrine of Cypre has been abused to redirect settlement money from class action lawsuits toward lawyers' favorite charities, as well as to their alma maters. Basically, plaintiffs and defendants' lawyers get together and tell the judge it would be too difficult to distribute settlement money to all the members of a class. Then they tell the judges they've agreed to give it to some nonprofits that they like instead, or that they want to use it to create some foundation at their alma mater. The judge usually agrees. Judges often get in on the action by directing some of the money to the nonprofits they like, as well as their own alma maters. As with bank settlements, corporations would much rather take photographs of themselves delivering fat checks to beloved nonprofits than mail thousands of tiny checks to faceless class members. For instance, in one class action settlement against Google's practice of divulging its users' search queries to third parties, instead of going for the massive $1,000 per violation statutory damages Google was on the hook for, the lawyers settled for a paltry $8.5 million, $2 million of which went to themselves, and the rest of which went to some charities affiliated with both Google and the lawyers. The lawyers' alma maters, Chicago Kent and Harvard Law, also got some money. In a different Google case, Federal District Judge James Ware rewrote the settlement to direct $500,000 to his own alma mater, Santa Clara University of Law, where he taught classes. The money, I'm not joking about this, went to fund a center on ethics. It's the same basic scam as the DOJ stuff, just the judicial system's version of it. Everyone gets to wet their beak. The loyal law school graduate goes out into the world, gets a big kill, and drags the carcass back to their alma mater to impress it. Nonprofits get million-dollar checks. The corporation writing them turns a potential scandal into a PR win. Everyone wins, except for the actual members of the class who were harmed to begin with. But the beauty of this scam is that it's a class action lawsuit. The members of the class don't even know they were supposed to get anything, so they'll never miss it. Another masterful trick from the woke industrial complex. It's not just nonprofits that have become the accomplices of woke capitalism. It's our own government agencies, which is even worse. When the judicial branch funnels corporate settlement money to nonprofits, it's fleecing money from the people who are harmed by those corporations. When the executive branch does it, it's diverting money from the U.S. Treasury and therefore from all taxpayers. By doing so, it deprives Americans not only of their money, but of their voice. The Constitution says that our elected representatives in Congress are supposed to debate each other in full view of the public and decide what to do with our money. This DOJ tactic of changing fines to donations to bypass the Treasury was part of a shadow war waged between the Obama administration and the Republican-controlled Congress. President Obama supported a lot of the policies that the Republicans in the House and Senate refused to make laws. Call it obstructionist, but that's life in a two-party system. There was nothing unconstitutional about it. But it violates the spirit and the letter of the Constitution for a frustrated executive branch to use its administrative powers to enact unofficial, undemocratic laws that it couldn't get through Congress. That's exactly what the Obama administration was doing when it used DOJ settlements with banks to fund its favored nonprofits. For example, Congress decided to cut $43 million in funding to community development, financial institutions, and housing counseling agencies. Then, as part of the bank's consumer relief penalties, the DOJ had it turn around and pay more than $100 million to those exact same groups. Maybe that was good policy, maybe not. But there's no denying that Congress, which holds the constitutional power of the purse, decided to cut funding to those groups, and the executive branch immediately used its power to create a new purse and dole out money from it. The executive branch is charged to enact Congress's laws, not to outright defy it by creating its own. Remember Volkswagen? That big scandal where it preached about how environmentally friendly its cars were, and it turned out it just installed hardware to cheat on all those tests? Volkswagen comes back into this story about the woke industrial complex too. And the DOJ is again a star, once again acting as the shadow legislature. President Obama had promised to put 1 million electric vehicles on the road by 2015 and asked Congress for $300 million to make it happen. Congress refused. Constitutionally speaking, that should have been the end of it. But the Obama administration bypassed the Treasury and realized it could use Volkswagen as its piggy bank. The DOJ forced Volkswagen into a settlement where it had to invest $1.2 billion in creating electric vehicle charging stations, and it had to get the EPA to approve the plan. But the EPA isn't created or even designed to know the best way to invest $1 billion into new technology, just like the DOJ wasn't created to find funding for democratic priorities whenever Congress refuses. But like nonprofits, those administrative agencies became the willing henchmen of the woke industrial complex. Part of being a loyal henchman is that you don't just reward your boss's friends, you punish their enemies. And that's what the DOJ has become, a goon squad that kicks down the doors of wokeness's public enemies. This was most evident in the way it took down public villain Martin Shkreli. One rule of woke capitalism is that jerks who obviously care only about money don't get to keep making it. Shkreli violated that rule, and the DOJ came down on him like a ton of bricks. I met Shkreli for the first time in 2013. I was 28 years old. When I read in Forbes magazine about a guy around my age who had graduated from Baruch College and was supposedly the young savant of the biotech industry, I was reflexively skeptical. And if I'm being honest, even a little envious. But when I met him, I could tell within minutes he was brilliant. I was still an investment analyst, and he was the young CEO of a company called Retrofin. His knowledge of genetic diseases was encyclopedic. He knew the clinical data of his competitors cold. He often knew more than even their own scientists. He was a rare genius. Yet I also learned pretty quickly that he was pathologically incapable of telling the truth. He wasn't a liar in the conventional sense. Rather, it seemed that he was literally incapable of distinguishing fact from fiction, like some type of rare genetic anomaly that made him agnostic to objective truth, let alone rules or norms. The media would later portray him as a pharma bro, because he was once photographed wearing sunglasses and a douchey-looking outfit. But they fundamentally missed the mark. He wasn't a bro. He was a semi-autistic idiot savant with a hardwired inability to tell the truth. In that first meeting, Shkreli told me unprompted that he had attended Columbia University but dropped out to go to Baruch College instead. As part of my due diligence, I called Columbia's admissions office and asked whether he'd ever been admitted there. He hadn't. So I wasn't shocked when he lied about the other basic stuff, too. At one point during my due diligence, he started to volunteer confidential information. I told him to stop since I was a public markets investor and could only be exposed to public information. He laughed and said, "Look, man, this is Wall Street." It was as though he was trying to act out his childhood dream of starring in his favorite movie. Maybe that was his sin. Martin Shkreli just wanted to be the Wolf of Wall Street. He didn't just want to make money. He wanted everyone to know he cared about nothing else. So ironically, he didn't actually care only about money. He cared even more about making sure everyone knew that. Martin Shkreli didn't dream of being rich. He dreamed of being a rich asshole and being famous for it. I watched from afar as he became an industry pariah for acquiring Daraprim, a medication to treat a rare condition in certain HIV patients, and jacking the price over 5,000% from $13.50 to $750 per pill. He became the poster boy for greed of the pharmaceutical industry. His desire for attention did him few favors. While the media continually misunderstood him as a pharma bro, I was certain that he was relishing fame that he mistook for popularity. Popularity he hadn't enjoyed in his youth as a nerdy son of immigrants. Martin Shkreli wasn't a pharma bro. That's the tragedy of his story. He was acting out a poor kid's lonely fantasy of what being one was like. That's why he became a caricature. He'd always been viewing the glamorized life from the outside, and even after he found his way to Wall Street and became his two-dimensional image of a pharma bro, he still never really knew what it was like. Here's how the case that took him down started. As I take you through the details, ask yourself this. What was Martin Shkreli really punished for? In December 2015, Shkreli was charged with securities fraud for orchestrating schemes to defraud investors in two hedge funds he managed, along with a scheme to misappropriate more than $11 million in Retrofin assets to cover investment losses at the hedge funds. The SEC had been investigating Shkreli since 2012. He popped up on its radar after abandoning his financial obligations on a large short sale position, leaving his broker with a $7 million loss. The Wall Street Journal reported that the SEC probe took priority after Shkreli raised the price of Daraprim overnight. It was obvious that prosecutors really wanted to punish Shkreli for his actions with Daraprim, but it was also clear that their case was murky. But Shkreli was already guilty in the court of public opinion, no matter the charge. His notoriety grew to unprecedented heights with each of his increasingly obscene antics. He shelled out $2 million on Once Upon a Time in Shaolin, an unreleased Wu-Tang Clan album, and said that he'd play it only for Taylor Swift in exchange for sexual favors. While out on bail, awaiting the outcome of his trial, he offered a bounty of $5,000 for a strand of Hillary Clinton's hair. A federal judge revoked Shkreli's bail over that, sending him back to jail. Shkreli was convicted on 3 of 8 counts and sentenced to 7 years in prison. It's at least noteworthy that he was acquitted by the jury on a majority of the DOJ's charges. His defense had centered on the fact that the investors he'd defrauded made money in the end. He'd lied in various ways to investors in his hedge funds, mostly to conceal big losses. Eventually, he told them he was shutting the hedge funds down and offered them shares of his company Retrofin instead of returning the cash they'd given him. And of course, he'd defrauded shareholders of Retrofin by taking assets from it to cover up his hedge fund losses. Ultimately, both his Retrofin and hedge fund investors made money because those Retrofin shares ended up becoming very valuable. So that's the story of Shkreli's rise and fall. Let's come back to the question I asked earlier. What was Martin Shkreli really guilty of? Why did the DOJ go after him so hard when it lets others quietly get away with much worse? In January 2018, I attended the annual J.P. Morgan Healthcare Conference. I got drinks with the CEO of one of the largest biopharmaceutical companies. After downing a couple, he said something about Shkreli that stuck with me. The reason they got him is because of what he did to that drug's price. Of course, I would never say that publicly. He was right. The only acceptable public line for any biotech or pharma CEO about Shkreli is that he was a villain. That was the pharma industry's goal, to make clear that Schiaparelli wasn't one of us. And he was indeed an outsider. He wasn't a polished executive. He was a lonely kid with serious psychological issues who was desperate for attention. That's what made him an outsider, not his business practices. In reality, he did what many other pharma companies do every single day, different not in kind, but only in degree. Martin Schiaparelli may have committed fraud, but the reason the DOJ punished him for it is that he was an asshole who was bringing too much heat down on all the more polished pharmaceutical elites. Schiaparelli jacked up drug prices and propositioned Taylor Swift instead of paying lip service to the immutable laws of intersectionality. That's what the system got him for. The same system that got him tells us who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. And we all know who Schiaparelli was, the worst of the bad guys. And we all know who the good guys are, too. Guys like Unilever CEO Alan Jope, who fight gender stereotypes and harness the power of intersectionality to protect all women by protecting women of color. So Schiaparelli's a bad guy, and Jope is a good guy. But whom did Schiaparelli hurt? The people he was convicted for defrauding all ended up richer. The people who used Daraprim didn't pay more for it. The cost was split up across the whole health insurance system. But those Kenyan tea pickers who were begging the UN to make Unilever admit it failed to protect them, they were hurt very badly. And Unilever could help them without even noticing the money was gone. But it won't. That's because it's not about the money for Unilever, though it was all about the money for Schiaparelli. If Unilever compensates those women or even acknowledges it wronged them, it loses its sterling reputation as one of the good guys. That's why instead of helping its Kenyan tea pickers, it's dropping $1 million a year to get UN women to praise it for protecting every other tea worker. Unilever has to be seen as the one who protects women from rape, not the one who allowed it. The fact that it did allow it is irrelevant. It's got too much invested in its reputation to admit the truth. And that's one of the problems with wokeness. Corporations aren't people, but in one way they're exactly alike. Whether you're a corporation or a person, if you aspire to a reputation for goodness and achieve it, at some point, maintaining the appearance of virtue becomes more important than virtue itself. Woke nonprofits are silent middlemen in the woke industrial game. They allow corporations to buy the appearance of virtue by paying nonprofits to speak in their behalf. In this game, nonprofits are the puppets, and corporations are the puppet masters. That's simple enough. But this is where our story takes a dark turn. On the global stage, the corporations themselves become puppets too. So who's pulling their strings? The answer is downright frightening. Chapter 8: When Dictators Become Stakeholders. In October 2017, I was aboard a flight to a place that had never been very high on my destination list. Saudi Arabia. The occasion for the trip was the first ever Future Investment Initiative Global Conference, one that was quickly dubbed Davos in the Desert. The conference shared a lot in common with the World Economic Forum in Davos and the annual Milken Institute Global Conference in Los Angeles. The same billionaire class was in attendance. They used the same private jets to travel to all three. They drank wine in Davos, whiskey in Los Angeles, and sparkling grape juice in Riyadh. In Davos, they talk about the promise of ESG. In Los Angeles, they talk about the American dream. And in Riyadh, they talk about spreading technology in the Middle East. The big theme in 2017 when I visited Riyadh was the unveiling of a new technological city called NEOM, in which flying robots and human beings would cohabit a space where they traveled via flying cars. But in all three places, the goal was to set an agenda that entrepreneurs and CEOs were expected to follow, especially young CEOs like me, who were dependent on investments from people like them. Some of these investors were institutional investment firms, like mutual funds or hedge funds, but the largest and most important ones of all were sovereign nations, like Singapore, Norway, China, and Saudi Arabia. I had received a special invitation to visit Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS as he's known, the newly anointed crown prince of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, at the Royal Palace. After landing in Riyadh, I spent most of the day waiting at a nearby hotel along with a small group of CEOs who had also received the same invitation. After a few hours, the group received a call to notify us that the Crown Prince was ready. So we proceeded to the palace in a caravan of black SUVs. During the car ride, another CEO advised me to approach the visit the same way Fortune 500 CEOs behave when they visit the White House. When in doubt, shut up and listen, and always let them know that you're ready to help. Upon arriving at the palace, we waited for a couple more hours before being escorted to a special room in the basement. Soon enough, the Crown Prince arrived. Each CEO stood individually as they spoke and addressed him as Your Highness, and his royal sidekicks as Your Excellency. I did the same. Several of them expressed fealty to the nation of Saudi Arabia in various ways and volunteered to launch ambitious collaborations with the kingdom to help advance the Crown Prince's sweeping Vision 2030 plan. I was captivated, fascinated, and even a bit smitten with the new Crown Prince, who, despite being my age, was seemingly determined to modernize an entire society. He was arrestingly knowledgeable about the different areas of science and technology, spoke fluent English, and listened carefully to what every CEO in the room told him. Shortly after the trip, safely back in the United States, I read in the news that MBS had indefinitely imprisoned nearly 100 business leaders on unspecified charges of corruption. The same hotel where my peers had stayed only weeks ago, the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh, was used as a makeshift prison to house them. After that, they came for the feminists. As MBS paid lip service to the cause of women's rights, he jailed its most vocal supporters. Feminist leaders were reportedly jailed without charges or trials, then tortured and sexually assaulted. Many of them remain imprisoned today. Next, they came for Jamal Khashoggi, a contributor to the Washington Post. In Turkey, they lured him into a trap as he entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul to get documents for his upcoming marriage. A team of Saudi operatives was waiting for him. They tortured him, strangled him to death, and dismembered his body with a bone saw. Then Saudi Arabia denied it. Once it was confronted with overwhelming evidence, it denied MBS had anything to do with it and trotted a few guys to take the fall. The Saudis had sent a 15-man team to the consulate, including a forensics doctor. The mission was led by Ahmad al-Asiri, a close advisor to MBS. News reports claim the Crown Prince personally assigned the assassination to him, though the Saudis deny that. 7 of the 15 hitmen were MBS's personal bodyguards. Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund was an investor in an investment fund that had invested in my own company. As it turns out, that's why I'd been invited to meet the Crown Prince in the first place. After the Khashoggi incident, one of my close advisors gave me an alarming warning to keep an eye on the situation. "Just be careful with those guys," he warned me, referring to the Saudis. When I probed what he meant, he just responded, "Well, they probably don't execute CEOs. Just keep your eyes open." Maybe the Crown Prince directly ordered the killing of Khashoggi. Maybe he didn't. Who can know such things? All I know is I haven't returned to Riyadh. But if the behavior of Saudi Arabia was suspect, China's is far more frightening. I've done business in China too, and it's not rosy. Last year, the Chinese government expressly warned that it's willing to deploy government-backed scare tactics, even in private business negotiations. China said it might detain U.S. nationals following the U.S. Justice's prosecution of Chinese researchers accused of hiding their ties to the Chinese military. It's well known that China has previously detained U.S. citizens and sentenced Canadian, Australian, and Swedish citizens on charges with little or no factual or legal basis. The U.S. State Department issued its own warning to echo this reality. Chinese business leaders have experienced similar setbacks when they've run afoul of the ruling party. For example, when Chinese President Xi Jinping caught wind that the prominent entrepreneur Jack Ma had made comments critical of government regulators, he personally pulled the plug on the IPO of Ma's Ant Financial the day before it was due to debut as the largest IPO in world history. Other prominent Chinese business leaders, including Wang Jianlin, once the richest man in China, have been the targets of Xi's wrath when they strayed too far from the party line, even in private. American critics of Donald Trump portrayed him as an aspiring autocrat with the sensibilities of a Scorsese mob boss. But Trump's influence over American industry was insignificant compared to the iron rule of Xi and his cronies over every company that does business in China. Rulers like Xi and MBS are the greatest threat democracy will face over the next decade. And now the dictators have discovered a new arrow in their quiver: wokeness. There's even a new Chinese word for wokeness: Weitzwo, referring specifically to woke white people. They use it to laugh at America. Don't get me wrong. Stakeholder capitalism didn't kill Jamal Khashoggi. Wokeness didn't create corruption in China. But it does aid the cover-up. Throughout this chapter, I'll show you how American corporations have become the pawns of foreign dictators, even as they portray themselves as paragons of virtue. They would still fawn over dictators in pursuit of profit, even without wokenomics entering the picture. That's just an evil of global capitalism itself in any form. But the key difference between stakeholder and shareholder models of capitalism is that the woke version crowns corporations with a patina of moral authority. I'll show you how foreign dictators use the moral stature of woke corporations to whitewash their own oppression and also to damage the moral standing of the United States on the global stage. In January 2020, Silicon Valley darling Airbnb shocked the business world when it announced that it would make decisions based on stakeholders, not just shareholders, when it comes to corporate governance. Among other things, the company planned to hold a stakeholder day as an alternative to the conventional annual shareholder one. CEO Brian Chesky committed to changing the company's compensation program, with factors important to stakeholders taken into account when bonuses are calculated. Sometimes woke companies are vague when making statements about stakeholders, but not Airbnb. It made a nice little chart that described the relationships that Airbnb hoped to have with its various stakeholders. Chesky was lionized for the announcement. But it turns out the handy chart conveniently omitted one of Airbnb's most important stakeholders, the Chinese Communist Party, or the CCP. About 7 months before Brian Chesky's declaration of love for stakeholders, Airbnb hired Sean Joyce, a former deputy director of the FBI, as its first chief trust officer. The purpose of the role was to protect users' safety on the platform. Yet in a move that Airbnb tried to sweep under the rug, Joyce resigned before the end of the year over concerns about how the behemoth was sharing data on millions of its users, without their knowledge, with the Chinese Communist Party. Guests and hosts are at the top of Airbnb's stakeholder list, yet it was stealing and sharing data from both of these stakeholders to share it with an even more important one. According to the Wall Street Journal, Joyce left because he was concerned that Airbnb wasn't transparent with its users about the data that it regularly shares with the CCP. And Airbnb continued to expand the scope of data that it shared. Regularly shared data about American users includes phone numbers, email addresses, the content of messages between users and the company, according to unidentified sources within Airbnb. Chinese officials privately approached Airbnb with an unwritten request for even more data, including so-called real-time data about the users. Joyce worried that such data sharing would empower Chinese government surveillance and put members of minority ethnic groups at risk. Joyce elevated his concerns to senior executives, including Brian Chesky and his co-founder, Nathan Blacharczyk, with whom, incidentally, I crossed paths during our student days at Harvard. "We're not here to promote American values," Blacharczyk told Joyce. Joyce then resigned. His only public statement is that it was over a difference in values. I wish that people like Blacharczyk would say in public what they actually say behind closed doors. The American public deserves to hear the truth. Our system works pretty well when the American people know exactly what's going on. But the PR smokescreen of stakeholder capitalism prevents the American public and government from putting companies like Airbnb under the microscope. If Airbnb were honest, it would publicly admit what Blacharczyk said in private. "We're not here to promote American values." That's a perfectly legitimate thing for a company to say. On the other hand, if Airbnb really did care about promoting American values, then it would act accordingly. It would stand up to the CCP and say it wasn't going to siphon data provided to it by its trusting American users, and be damned if that meant losing access to China's lucrative market. That's how Airbnb could have demonstrated that it really cared about its stakeholders. But we're left with the worst of both worlds. Companies like Airbnb cultivate the public image that they care about society at large rather than their bottom line, while in reality abusing that public trust. The stakeholder smokescreen wasn't just a sideshow. It's an essential part of the story. Without earning trust that it never deserved, Airbnb wouldn't have been able to collect vast reams of consumer data. And no one has mastered this dark art better than China. In sum, here's how the game works. First, Black Lives Matter activists, or environmentalists, or feminists, or whoever, become the front for American technology companies to win consumer trust. Second, those companies monetize that trust by generating clicks, selling ads, and charging fees, generating a treasure trove of sensitive personalized data about each of their consumers. Third, the CCP demands access to that data as a condition for entry for companies to do business in China. Fourth, these companies supplicate to the CCP and make a killing in China. Fifth, they keep mum about their dealings in China while continuing to issue woke proclamations through their corporate megaphones. BLM wins. Silicon Valley wins. The CCP wins. The real losers of this game are the American people. The role of trendy stakeholderist values in this charade cannot be overstated. Companies like Airbnb would never command the blind allegiance of naive American users by simply selling a humdrum product. That's why they douse it in morality. They flaunt their wokeism precisely to win the trust of U.S. consumers, which in turn provides air cover when they betray those same consumers by handing over their data to the Chinese government. It's a dirty bribe to the CCP, plain and simple, one that leaves American consumers hanging dry. For many progressive consumers, it's easier to trust a company that posts a black square on its corporate Instagram account rather than one that posts a red flag with 5 golden stars. Yet Airbnb effectively gets to have it both ways, flaunting a sleek video titled, "We Stand With Hashtag Black Lives Matter," while quietly collaborating with the CCP without any mention of China on Instagram or anywhere else. The real evil isn't just the CCP gaining access to the private data of American consumers. That's just the scam. The deeper problem arises when the CCP flexes its muscle as a gatekeeper to the Chinese market to then convince corporations to spread the CCP's own values abroad. It does this implicitly through the rise of woke capitalism, with companies like Disney, Marriott, Apple, or the NBA expressing their moral outrage about injustices like systemic racism and transphobia in the United States, while staying completely silent about human rights abuses like concentration camps, forced sterilization of religious minorities, and beatings of innocent civilians in China. Over the last few years, the Chinese government has detained more than 1 million Uyghurs in concentration camps. The Uyghurs are a large ethnic minority who have lived in the Xinjiang region of China for at least 1,000 years. Over the centuries, they've gradually become predominantly Muslim, the heart of the cultural conflict between them and the CCP. The CCP at first denied that it was detaining Uyghurs at all. When confronted with satellite photos of its camps, it claimed that they were re-education camps meant to end the threat of Uyghur Islamic extremism, which had led to a number of terrorist attacks in the last decade. But the CCP's take on education looks a lot like cultural genocide to most Westerners. Chinese police look for signs of religious extremism, such as owning books about Uyghur history, growing a beard, having a prayer rug, or quitting drinking and smoking. They install cameras in private homes. Men are imprisoned without trial or charges for reciting verses from the Quran at funerals. Wives are sent to concentration camps, surrounded by barbed wire fences if their husbands are under suspicion. Inmates at the camps are beaten, insulted, and forced to write self-criticism essays and sing hymns in praise of the Communist Party. They're also forced to labor in factories producing goods for China to export. The CCP claims it's just giving them training and jobs, but the Uyghurs aren't given a chance to say no. The Chinese government isn't just brainwashing Uyghurs, enslaving them, and erasing their culture. It's forcibly sterilizing them. In June 2020, German anthropologist Adrian Zenz released a report alleging that Uyghur women are being compelled to have abortions, undergo sterilization surgeries, and be outfitted with IUDs, all under the threat of internment. He made a few startling statistical discoveries. For instance, in 2014, right before the CCP's campaign to control the Uyghurs, only 2.5% of all IUD placements in China occurred in Xinjiang. But by 2018, 80% of all new IUDs in China were in Xinjiang. The program seems to be having its intended effect. Between 2015 and 2018, population growth rates in the Uyghur regions of China plummeted 60%. If Zenz is right, the Chinese government is committing cultural genocide against the Uyghurs in a very literal sense, instead of killing them or controlling them, it's decided it's easier to prevent more from being born. While the Uyghurs suffer the worst of China's atrocities, they're far from alone. The Chinese Communist Party has taken advantage of the free rein given to it by the global pandemic to extend its brutal hand outward. Its soldiers attacked Indian ones on the supposedly demilitarized border in Ladakh, killing dozens in hand-to-hand fighting and executing the wounded by pushing them over a cliff. China's also rapidly building amphibious assault ships and aiming them squarely at Taiwan. It takes the U.S. years to build one of these powerful, expensive assault carriers loaded with helicopters and marines. China's churning out a new one every 6 months. The Communist Party has turned its all-seeing eye to another island, Hong Kong. When the British turned over Hong Kong to China in 1997, it was on the understanding that China would adhere to a one-country, two-systems principle. China agreed to the drafting and adoption of Hong Kong's basic law, a mini-constitution letting Hong Kong maintain its own unique capitalist system, currency, laws, and freedoms until 2047. But alarmed by pro-democracy demonstrations, the CCP broke its promise to allow Hong Kong autonomy and brought it under its thumb. In June 2020, the Chinese government passed a draconian national security law, setting up a new CCP-controlled agency to prosecute cases in Hong Kong and making those found guilty of sedition subject to punishments of up to life imprisonment. Alan Leong, former chair of Hong Kong's Bar Association, summed the new law up by saying, "We were allowing the long arms of the Chinese Communist Party to reach Hong Kong." The long arms of the CCP have reached all the way to America, too. When Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey tweeted from his personal account in support of Hong Kong, saying, "Fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong," the CCP was incensed. Turns out the Rockets do a lot of business in China, largely thanks to ex-Rockets star Yao Ming. And the NBA is trying to make inroads in the vast, basketball-crazy Chinese market. In other words, China was a big stakeholder in the Rockets' business. That stakeholder flexed its muscle. The Chinese consulate in Houston denounced Morey. Tillman Fertitta, the Rockets' owner, followed suit. Daryl Morey does not speak for the Houston Rockets. The Chinese Basketball Association announced that it would cease all cooperation with the Rockets. The NBA issued a statement calling Morey's tweet regrettable. The Rockets were reportedly considering firing Morey to appease China. All Chinese broadcasters refused to show any NBA games. Nike pulled all its Rockets gear from its stores in China. It wasn't just the CCP, its corporate minions, and the NBA that acted like Morey had done something inexcusable. Players joined in. Rockets star James Harden said, "We apologize. You know, we love China. We love playing there." Superstar LeBron James, known for his social justice advocacy, also threw his weight behind the cause to demonize Morey. LeBron had the misfortune of being in China for a preseason game between the Lakers and Nets right when Morey tweeted. LeBron claimed Morey had misused his right of freedom of speech, adding, "I believe he wasn't educated on the situation at hand." It's jarring when you compare LeBron's criticism of Morey to his vocal support of Black Lives Matter protesters and his frequent criticism of Donald Trump. LeBron spearheaded a get-out-the-vote effort called More Than a Vote, a laudable goal if he hadn't simultaneously been criticizing Morey's effort to allow voting in Hong Kong. The whole affair exposed a darkly hilarious truth. The NBA and its stars felt duty-bound to criticize America's president and judicial system, but considered it beyond the pale to criticize China's. It sounds great to some people when woke capitalists support the causes they like BLM. But the bottom line is always there, right there beneath the surface, dictating which causes a stakeholder capitalist supports. And what's worse is that foreign authoritarian nations understand the weakness of America's new stakeholder model far better than America does, and ruthlessly leverage their stakeholder status to selectively determine which causes the woke capitalists throw their weight behind. The NBA can put Black Lives Matter on all its courts because the CCP isn't threatened by that message. But the Communist Party would never allow the NBA or any of its employees to breathe a word in support of Hong Kong, Taiwan, or the Uyghurs. That imbalance lends a silent moral authority to all the CCP's oppressive acts. The people who are known for criticizing injustice never criticize it. China could invade Taiwan tomorrow with all those assault ships it's been building, and the NBA would act like nothing happened. So would Disney. After all, Disney wasn't bothered by all those concentration camps in Xinjiang. It got to film Mulan there. In the movie's credits, it thanked the CCP's propaganda bureau in Xinjiang for its assistance. Meanwhile, back at home, Disney's CEO said that it would be very difficult for Disney to film movies in Georgia if it implemented a new abortion ban because people wouldn't want to work there. It's tough to render Disney's decisions consistent. Maybe Disney's fine with forced sterilization, but it'd draw the line if the CCP forbade abortions. That was far from the first time that Disney had abased itself to appease the CCP's dictatorial tendencies. Before Mulan, Disney was worried about getting Doctor Strange approved in the lucrative Chinese market. The problem? The Ancient One, a prominent character in the comics, was a Tibetan monk. As with Taiwan, China thinks Tibet is part of China, and Tibet does not. Disney cut this Gordian knot by making the Ancient One white. Woke critics then howled that Disney had committed the cardinal sin of whitewashing by making an Asian character a white one. But they missed the real move, making a Tibetan character a white one. Disney had cunningly juked controversy with the CCP by inviting a woke controversy instead. As it turns out, woke activists are more easily appeased. To mollify them, Disney made the Tibetan monk a woman instead of a man, casting popular actress Tilda Swinton in the role. This isn't my take on things. It comes straight from Robert Cargill, the screenwriter of Doctor Strange. White woman washing the Ancient One was good for China, good for Disney, and good for feminism. Really, it was good for everyone but Tibet. Wokenomics whitewashes the abuses of dictators abroad while condemning actions of government at home. And that makes the U.S. less safe. Implicit in all this corporate doublespeak from companies like Disney and the NBA is a mechanism to elevate the moral standing of China as compared to the U.S. on the global stage. The moral standing of the United States is one of our greatest competitive advantages on the global stage. Autocratic dictatorships like China know this well and are now able to implicitly use their power over multinational corporations and the rise of woke capitalism as a tool to chip away at that advantage. Over the long run, that weakens the geopolitical standing of the U.S. by creating a false moral equivalence to China, even though there's no comparison between how, say, black people are treated in America as compared to how Uyghurs are treated in China. Xi Jinping himself took advantage of this. When European officials criticized him for China's treatment of the Uyghurs, he smoothly pivoted to pointing out how the BLM movement shows U.S. human rights problems. In March 2021, Chinese diplomat Yang Jiechi followed suit at the U.S.-China summit in Alaska when he falsely claimed that black Americans were being slaughtered and that we hope the United States will do better on human rights. There's a special irony to all of this. The only reason that companies like the NBA or Disney are able to criticize social injustice in the U.S., even those that pale in comparison to day-to-day reality in China, is because our liberal democracy permits them to. By contrast, China imprisons those who publicly dissent against the CCP and would punish corporations that fail to follow its party line. Yet paradoxically, that has empowered the CCP to co-opt American companies to do the CCP's own bidding back home in America. They're turning multinational corporations into Trojan horses to achieve their longer-run geopolitical objectives. These companies then come back to the U.S. with pent-up moral frustration for what they can't say in China, and let off their moral steam back home through the performative acts of woke capitalism. Then when some of the very largest of these corporations find the absence of a single dictatorial overlord back home in the U.S., they choose to fill that void themselves by becoming the dictators who decide what the right moral norms should be. Yet all the while, their real bosses in the true global hierarchy are the real dictators in places like China, where the government uses access to the world's second largest market as a condition to achieve its geopolitical ends. The American people would never let that happen if they actually knew what was going on. That's what makes stakeholder capitalism so dangerous. It tricks us into allowing large multinational companies and their dictatorial overlords abroad to do what we would have never allowed them to do if we knew what was actually happening. Companies like Airbnb, Disney, and the NBA gain moral clout when they preach about how much they care about stakeholders at home. But then they turn around and use that moral clout to implicitly endorse atrocities abroad when foreign dictators flex their own stakeholder status. That's the key difference between stakeholder and shareholder capitalism. If corporations never gained unearned moral authority to begin with, they couldn't be weaponized so easily by authoritarian stakeholders. The CCP is the spider at the center of the global web of stakeholder capitalism. This theoretical observation is borne out by the actions of American companies abroad. For example, when Google first drafted its code of conduct for employees in 2000, it famously included the line, "Don't be evil." Google seems to have quickly forgotten that rule when it went abroad to do business in China. Its initial Chinese search engine enabled censorship by state authorities from 2006 to 2010. But after being the victim of Chinese hacking efforts, Google eventually announced that it would no longer comply with mainland Chinese censorship and relocated to Hong Kong. Upon leaving mainland China, Google tried to make a virtue of necessity, with Sergey Brin speaking out against the forces of totalitarianism. That lip service to freedom of speech earned Google applause in the West, but the truth is that the company quickly sought to return to China by any means necessary. Unbeknownst to virtually all of the company's employees, a team of engineers were assigned to work on a search system, codenamed Dragonfly, that would require users to log in to perform searches, track their location, and share their data with a Chinese partner that would have unilateral access to the data. Terms like human rights and student protest would be blacklisted. Being evil was back in style. It was only when an internal memo about this project leaked to The Intercept and embarrassed the company by revealing the insincerity of its statements about free speech that it quietly shuttered this effort. We'll see if it's revived in the coming years. Google is just one example among many. Apple, for its part, has removed from its Chinese App Store messaging apps that allowed users to bypass government-imposed firewalls and hid the Taiwanese flag emoji from users in Hong Kong and Macau. It has also removed songs from iTunes that reference Tiananmen Square. It's not just the tech companies that bend over backward for those sweet Chinese profits. As usual, Wall Street has gotten in on the action. The Wall Street Journal summed up the situation in an article titled, "China Has One Powerful Friend Left in the U.S., Wall Street." And it turns out that the CCP's very best friend on Wall Street is Larry Fink. BlackRock and Larry Fink, you may remember from earlier in this book, happen to be the poster boys for stakeholder capitalism in the West. Fink's defense of the idea is described in glowing terms in Klaus Schwab's recent book, Stakeholder Capitalism. Schwab approvingly cites a 2018 letter when Fink writes, "To prosper over time, every company must not only deliver financial performance, but also show how it makes a positive contribution to society." Wise words indeed. But which society did he mean? To hear the Wall Street Journal tell it, Fink is increasingly preoccupied with making a positive contribution to Chinese society, often at the expense of American interests. As he put it in a more recent letter to BlackRock shareholders, "I continue to firmly believe China will be one of the biggest opportunities for BlackRock over the long term, both for asset managers and investors." The Wall Street Journal says that to pursue this opportunity, Fink had BlackRock throw its weight behind controversial initiatives championed by Chinese leadership, such as getting Chinese stocks listed on indexes in spite of their questionable bookkeeping practices, opening them up to billions more in investment. Shortly after BlackRock provided its support to the CCP returned the favor by approving its application to start a fund in China. China's not the only dictatorship that loves to use American companies to do its dirty work. Saudi Arabia has also relied on U.S. companies to suppress internal opposition. An episode of a comedy show that featured American comedian Hasan Minhaj criticizing the Saudi crown prince for the murder of Khashoggi was removed from Netflix at the request of the regime. Saudis have done more than just remove offensive content. They've also used U.S. companies to remove the offenders. The social responsibility page for the elite consulting firm McKinsey & Company states, "Our purpose as a firm is to help create positive, enduring change in the world," and mentions the importance of empowering our people to give back to their communities, operating our firm in ways that are socially responsible and environmentally sustainable, and working with our clients to intentionally address societal challenges. The Saudi government is one of McKinsey's clients, and one of the Saudi government's societal challenges is dissent. According to a recent New Yorker article, McKinsey prepared a report quantifying public perception of Saudi economic policies that identified the three individuals driving the bulk of the negative coverage on Twitter. A writer in Saudi Arabia named Khalid Al-Alkami, a dissident in Canada, Omar Abdulaziz, and a third anonymous account. McKinsey's research proved useful for the regime, and they went out of their way to intentionally address the issue. Al-Alkami was arrested, Abdulaziz's brothers living in Saudi Arabia were put in prison, and the anonymous Twitter channel was shut down. If authoritarian regimes were only interested in suppressing dissent internally, that would be bad enough. But again and again, they have sought to pressure American corporations to restrict the speech of employees in the U.S. critical of the Chinese government. Witness what happened to Daryl Morey when he supported pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. Hollywood is no exception to this obeisance. Casting decisions, content, dialogue, and plot lines are increasingly edited to appease the censors in Beijing. The sequel to Top Gun, expected to be released in 2021, provides an illustrative example. In the original film, Tom Cruise wears a leather bomber jacket that belonged to his late father. The jacket has patches from his dad's U.S. Navy tours and includes flags from allies, including Taiwan and Japan. For the sequel, those politically problematic flags were removed from the jacket. So much for being a maverick. Remember Disney's note publicly thanking the CCP's propaganda department for helping it film Mulan in Xinjiang? That would be analogous to a note at the end of Disney's 1941 film Dumbo, thanking the local Reich main security office in Theresienstadt and the Reich Ministry of Public Enlightenment and Propaganda in the Sudetenland for their assistance. Mickey Mouse always says thank you for his cheese. Incidentally, Disney's recent collaboration with the authorities in Xinjiang does not appear in Disney's most recent corporate social responsibility report. The more we go woke, the easier it becomes for countries like China to co-opt woke methods to serve their own ends. Consider one product of wokeness on college campuses in recent years, the emergence of trigger warnings to students before being exposed to ideas that may challenge their presuppositions on social questions like race, gender, or climate change. It turns out that China took note of the effectiveness of this woke movement. In 2020, based on a new Chinese law, top universities, including Harvard and Princeton, have begun to label certain courses with a warning label if they teach any material that China considers sensitive. And there's a growing list of subjects that Beijing considers to be off-limits. In response, at Princeton, students in a Chinese politics class now use codes instead of names on their essays to protect their identities. At Amherst College, one professor is shifting to anonymous online chats so students can speak freely. Harvard Business School now excuses students from discussing politically sensitive topics relevant to China if they're worried about the risks of doing so. While class participation is normally an element of students' grades, if amnesty is put in place for political reasons, students won't be penalized for opting out. The new law in China that prompted these changes is one that bars what it calls sedition, subversion, terrorism, and colluding with foreign forces. Chinese authorities have made clear that this law applies not only within China, but also in Hong Kong, and now even outside Hong Kong, including in the U.S. What's striking is that the same approach used by woke activists to constrain the scope of acceptable speech, like trigger warnings in college course catalogs, is now being copied by the Chinese Communist Party at the very same institutions. Woke activists and Chinese autocrats may make for strange bedfellows, but they are increasingly using the same methods in the very same places. Ibram Kendi and Xi Jinping both have an alarmingly similar effect on what can and can't be said at U.S. companies or universities. What struck me was how fear-inspiring China has become, even among America's otherwise fearless icons. In 2020, I had a chance to participate in a group dialogue with John McEnroe during the U.S. Open. McEnroe was without doubt a legendary tennis champion, but there are many players who have won more Grand Slam titles than McEnroe did. You don't have to be a tennis fan to know that John McEnroe is never afraid to speak his mind. He used to curse at umpires as a player. Today, while serving as a commentator on ESPN, he's unafraid to say things that often offend other tennis players and make his fellow commentators cringe. During the U.S. Open, the tournament organization made a decision to conform to the NBA's approach by creating visible signs in the stadium to support the Black Lives Matter movement, in solidarity with the black community following the death of George Floyd. Yet unlike the NBA or NFL, the Association of Tennis Players, or ATP, is a truly global professional league. At the time, I wondered whether the ATP's step of promulgating social values in the United States would continue when it hosted tournaments in the Middle East or China, where human rights abuses go far beyond anything we've seen in the United States for nearly two centuries. So I decided to ask the one guy who I expected would give me a straight answer, John McEnroe. Yet even he demurred. "That's a big question, a loaded question," he said in response. "I'm glad the sport is able to have a positive impact, and those are big questions about China and the Middle East. I'm so proud of the impact that tennis has had around the world." And that was it. If even John McEnroe feared the CCP, I knew there was something to worry about. China and Saudi Arabia have cracked the code of stakeholder capitalism. They've realized a simple truth, the same one I learned years ago during my summer at Goldman Sachs. Whoever has the gold makes the rules. But it used to be that those rules were limited to financial transactions. Thanks to woke capitalism, the rules of morality itself are now up for sale. You won't find a bigger, more powerful stakeholder than a wealthy authoritarian government, and they're always ready to buy your silence. Under the old shareholder model, American corporations might still prostrate themselves at the feet of dictators to make a buck, but they wouldn't come out of it smelling like a rose. We'd all see them as the money grubbers they were and judge them accordingly. But stakeholder capitalism gives us the worst of both worlds. Woke capitalists in America get to make money with their dictator buddies abroad and act like they're saving the world back home. The public outrage from the business community about Khashoggi's assassination was short-lived. U.S. companies' condemnation of the murder were motivated by the acute demands of social justice activists. But those demands were fleeting as the activists eventually found other causes to champion. The initial fever pitch gradually gave way to silence, and the cost-benefit analysis for multinational corporations tipped back in favor of monarchical deference. Fund managers and corporate executives gradually went back to doing business in Saudi Arabia, just as they had done before. Richard Branson had rejected the proposed Saudi investment in Virgin Galactic in 2018, but by the next fall, his affiliated company, Virgin Hyperloop, was doing business in Saudi Arabia again. Indeed, in 2019, Virgin Hyperloop's CEO said it was delighted to return to the Future Investment Initiative conference, which Branson had boycotted only a year prior. Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi retreated from his initially critical stance in 2018. During a November 2019 interview, he said the murder of Khashoggi was a mistake, but that Uber had made mistakes too, with self-driving, drawing an equivalence between a targeted assassination of a journalist and a pedestrian accident involving a self-driving car. McKinsey & Company went back to charging a small fortune for advising clients on how to do business in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The cottage industry, built around opening up personal connections in the Middle East, was soon humming once again. To be sure, most business leaders still haven't forgotten about the Khashoggi episode. In private, they'll admit that they're personally more timid about traveling to Saudi Arabia and a tad bit more afraid for their own safety. For those few who do still personally travel to the region, they're much more mindful of what they say. The real world is complicated. Personally, I don't plan on visiting the Royal Palace again, but I did learn something during my visit to the palace in 2017 that stuck with me ever since then. When the Crown Prince spoke to a small group of us in a conference room that day, he was well aware that many people viewed him skeptically for making unprecedentedly large venture investments into massively unprofitable companies with big dreams for the future. "Some people think it is foolish to invest such vast sums because that means that more money will chase fewer opportunities, which means that investment returns will go down," he said. The monarch was correct about what others thought back then. His combination of financial acumen, nuance, and self-awareness impressed me. But I see it differently, he continued. My view is that the sheer size of our investments will create new opportunities that otherwise would not exist without us. And that's why we'll make the most money in the end. It will be another decade or so before we know whether the Crown Prince's prediction was correct. So far, he's doing pretty well. MBS understood something about the relationship between long-term investment and innovation that most ordinary fund managers do not. Patience pays, and betting big is a competitive advantage. My own experience as an entrepreneur suggests that his remarks were spot on. At the time my company accepted the $1 billion check from the fund in which the Saudis had invested, we had yet to complete a phase 3 trial for any of the drugs in our pipeline. The first drug to complete phase 3 was a high-profile, high-risk, high-reward bet to develop the first new treatment for Alzheimer's disease in over a generation. It was deeply personal for me. My mother was a geriatric psychiatrist who dedicated her life to treating Alzheimer's patients in nursing homes, and one of my grandmother's sisters in Vredikingeri had died of Alzheimer's disease. It was important to our business and to the world if it succeeded. But in the end, that trial ended in spectacular failure, just like every other valiant attempt in the field by other companies, large and small. Unlike those larger pharma enterprises, a high-profile clinical trial failure for a young biotech startup usually spells the end of the road. Yet my vision, and mercifully that of my investors too, had been to create an engine that produced many drugs over the long run, not just one. That meant enduring failure along the way. With a $1 billion investment in hand, I had a chance to realize that longer-term vision. No single clinical trial was going to make or break the company. The Alzheimer's failure was painful, but thanks to the massive capital investment, it wasn't existential. Our next phase 3 trial was one for an overactive bladder treatment, one that also affected elderly patients. It was a less serious disease than Alzheimer's, but it mattered to the people who had it, most of whom were also elderly. I was prepared for another failure, but thankfully, it was a resounding success. The next trial was for a drug to treat uterine fibroids. That one succeeded too, and so did the one after, in endometriosis. And then we flipped over an unexpectedly positive card on our phase 3 study in prostate cancer in late 2019. And then once again for a pair of phase 3 studies in psoriasis the following year. All told, out of the 9 phase 3 trials spawned by my company, the first one was an epic failure, but the next 8 were unambiguous successes. In retrospect, that $1 billion check in 2017 made all the difference. It was the difference between playing the lottery and playing the long game. It was quite possibly the difference between having a company and not having one at all. Running out of cash is a biotech company's equivalent of getting chopped up with a bone saw. Capital is what kept my company's blood flowing rather than spilling. Patients around the world will be better off for it. A good story usually ends with a neat lesson, but I'm not sure that this one does. Chapter 9. The Silicon Leviathan. Big corporations aren't just becoming the flunkies of dictators abroad. They're learning from those autocrats, and then they're becoming dictators in their own right, back here at home. A friend shared a striking story with me from his time at Facebook over a decade ago. He was in a closed-door meeting led by Chamath Palihapitiya, Facebook's executive in charge of its growth strategy at the time. Chamath asked the question of what it would take for Facebook to achieve sovereignty, and raised the possibility of eventually having a Facebook militia. Not an allegorical militia, like a sales force for selling its ads, but an actual armed militia. The idea that this would even cross the mind of one of Silicon Valley's titans is downright frightening. Chamath subsequently left Facebook and went on to found a firm called Social Capital, a new woke venture capital fund whose mission is to advance humanity. He's built a sterling reputation for himself by publicly criticizing social media companies for ripping apart society while becoming a part owner of the Golden State Warriors and a Silicon Valley celebrity on the back of his appreciated ownership in Facebook. I haven't heard him publicly float his one-time idea about starting a private militia for Facebook. Not a great look for a newly woke capitalist. While doing research for this book, I was struck to learn that the Dutch East India Company once wielded its own militia, behaving as though it were a sovereign entity in its own right. It also had its own currency, not dissimilar from the cryptocurrency that Facebook wanted to launch. Today, Silicon Valley represents the reincarnation of the Dutch East India Company in the 21st century, except this time firmly on American soil, after its companies sidestepped the safeguards in our system that were designed to protect against exactly that result. Like its predecessors in the old world, big tech has gradually grown into a corporate monster, though the giant slept until recently. Today, over two centuries after the birth of the American corporation, that corporate monster has finally emerged from its slumber. Over the last decade, the monster has quietly escaped the cage of capitalism. It now roams freely over all terrains of American life, and in 2020, the monster finally pounced on its most prized prey, American democracy itself. Its attack was as staggering as it was sudden. Silicon Valley's titans restricted debates between ordinary Americans, just as monarchs like MBS do in Saudi Arabia. They appointed themselves as the sole arbiters of truth and science and silenced dissent, just as the CCP does in China. They banished century-old newspapers. They interfered in our elections in unprecedented ways. During widespread state-imposed lockdowns during the pandemic, YouTube, owned by Google's parent company Alphabet, banned videos that were critical of COVID-19-related policies, including content posted by medical professionals arguing that lockdowns were excessive or unnecessary. Its stated justification? To remove medically unsubstantiated content in favor of facts from authoritative sources. According to YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki, anything that would go against World Health Organization recommendations would be a violation of our policy. In early 2021, YouTube did the same thing by censoring the U.S. Senate testimony of a doctor who made the medical case for ivermectin, a little-known tropical medicine, to treat severe COVID-19 patients with no explanation other than to say it violated its misinformation policy. Apparently, it was good enough for the U.S. Senate to hear, but not for the American people to hear. The list of examples of YouTube's censorship continues to grow each day. Its approach is flawed on multiple levels. First, it wrongly conflates empirical fact-finding with normative policymaking. Facts are important inputs to make sound policy decisions, but facts and policy judgments are not the same thing. It's one thing for someone to wrongly assert that bandanas were more effective than N95 masks in preventing person-to-person transmission of the coronavirus. It's another matter to treat anti-lockdown arguments as though those arguments themselves are incorrect facts. Whether a lockdown of certain businesses to prevent the coronavirus from spreading is the right policy isn't a matter of fact or science. It's a policy judgment, and the best policy may vary depending on what the business is, where it is, and myriad other factors. The lifeblood of our democracy is open debate about our public policies. Whether to implement lockdowns to stop the spread of COVID-19 was one of the most important public policy debates of 2020. Treating policy judgments as though they're facts is a threat to democracy. There's another problem. Using the WHO as a single source of truth is dangerous to science and to public health too. We now know that the WHO had reason to believe in December 2019, when Taiwan sent an emergency message to WHO leadership about a respiratory disease from China, that SARS-CoV-2 was contagious between humans. Yet the WHO does not recognize Taiwan due to pressure from China. The world suffered greatly as a consequence. The next month, the WHO echoed the claims of the Chinese Communist Party that there was no evidence of human-to-human transmission of the virus. An injustice somewhere became a pandemic everywhere. Under its stated standard, YouTube would have banned any videos in January 2020 that claimed that human-to-human transmission of COVID-19 was possible, given the official WHO stance at the time. In retrospect, that was arguably the most dangerous lie about public health in modern history. As of this writing, the issue